Biden has not treated this as a priority. This is actually part of the reason why the Biden administration did not go back into the deal during his first days in office through executive order, out of a fear that the political cost would be too high. Now, a year later, we see that that strategy backfired because the political cost is even higher today.
Trita Parsi, want to thank you for being with us with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Show your support for KBOO programming by picking up the special limited edition 2022 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Flaunt your love of bluegrass and KBOO with the stylish royal blue and neon yellow tee. Get yours now at kboo.fm/bgshirt.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Metro finds the controversial proposed ballot measure by People for Portland unconstitutional. The Oregon Department of Justice sues a COVID testing company for their questionable practices and results. And in national news, bird flu in chickens pushes up egg prices. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 8th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Lawyers for Metro say the controversial ballot measure put forward by the political group People for Portland is not allowed under Oregon's Constitution. The proposed ballot measure would reroute hundreds of millions of dollars that voters approved in 2020 to help fund housing services into building emergency shelters. It would also require cities to enforce anti-camping bans in order to keep their funding and audit that spending yearly. Metro lawyers say that the ballot can't go to voters because rules about distributing money can't be up to voters in the initiative process. Their argument also relies on another point, similar to the reasoning that Secretary of State Shamia Fagan gave for denying a ballot measure that would have created stricter campaign finance rules in the state. Neither proposed ballot measure contained the full text of the law that they would propose to change. The petition to get the initiative on the ballot has been denied by Metro, but People for Portland can still sue to challenge their decision. The Oregon Department of Justice is suing the COVID testing organization Center for COVID Control. The suit calls into question the test results they provided consumers. The Center for COVID Control had three sites in Oregon, but none were sanctioned or monitored by the local health authority at its Oregon locations. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The state of Oregon filed a lawsuit Thursday against the owners of an Illinois-based COVID-19 testing company. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum sued the Center for COVID Control, or CCC, and its partner, Doctors Clinical Laboratory, for deceptively marketing testing services and for violating Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The lawsuit says owners of CCC had no prior experience in the medical field, including medical testing. It states they funneled millions of dollars received from the federal government and insurance companies for testing to themselves. It specifically alleges CCC and Doctors Clinical Laboratory falsely told consumers they could provide accurate COVID-19 results within 72 hours, but instead produced questionable test results. It also alleges they lack proper capacity to store and process the thousands of test specimens they received each day. The lawsuit noted they're also being investigated by the FBI and Illinois public health authorities. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued CCC in January, accusing it of improperly handling tests and providing fake results. The CCC did not immediately comment, and a phone number listed on its website was disconnected. The website said CCC has paused its operations, quote, and will not resume collection of patient samples until staffing resources permit CCC to operate at full capacity, end quote. CCC allegedly grew from one testing site in Illinois to become one of the largest testing center operators in America, with 300 test sites across the U.S., including 5 in Oregon. The lawsuit filed in Multnomah County requests that CCC and Doctors Clinical Laboratory be banned permanently from offering COVID-19 testing in Oregon. It also asks for restitution for Oregonians who were victimized and for civil penalties up to $25,000 for each violation of Oregon law, plus attorney fees and the costs of Oregon's investigation. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Far-right anti-government activist and Idaho governor candidate Ammon Bundy has been sentenced to 10 days in Idaho jail. He also got a $3,000 fine because he didn't comply with an earlier sentence of community service, so now he's being held in contempt of court. That sentence was for trespassing at the Idaho State Capitol building in 2020 during an anti-COVID restriction protest. Bundy is best known in Oregon for his armed standoff at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in 2016, which left one man dead. The Multnomah County Board of Commissioners approved a plan to seek federal infrastructure dollars to help fund the design of a new Burnside Bridge. The board met yesterday and authorized their staff to apply for a $5 million grant from the Transportation Department's Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity Program. To get the grant, they'll have to match at least 20% of the funds they get, which county commissioners say will come from vehicle registration fee money. There's still a long way to go to fully fund replacing the Burnside Bridge. It's estimated to cost up to $915 million. There's about a third of that available from vehicle registration fees, so officials will have to look to other sources like state and federal government funding to support the cost. Why replace the Burnside Bridge? Well, it's hoped that a replacement of the bridge could survive a major earthquake from the Cascadia subduction zone. It's estimated that a severe earthquake of a magnitude 6 or greater has a 1 in 3 chance of hitting the region in the next 50 years, and roads and bridges would be hard hit if that happens. Few of the bridges over the Willamette River in Portland are expected to survive that kind of earthquake, so a new Burnside Bridge could be a lifeline between the east and west sides of the river. Depending on funding, the design process is expected to start in late 2022, and construction could start as soon as 2025. The Senate votes to confirm Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court, and the UN suspends Russia for human rights violations. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
She's a wife and a working mom. She is America at its best.
Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock commended Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as the Senate voted 53-47 in favor of her confirmation. When sworn in later this year to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, Brown will be the first Black woman to serve on the nation's high court. Republicans continued to criticize her record. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
Based on her record, I believe she will prove to be the furthest left of any justice to have ever served on the Supreme Court.
The House of Representatives is considering making changes to lawmakers' ability to trade individual stocks while holding office. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jonah Goose spoke in favor of the change to prevent the appearance of impropriety.
We are elected to serve the people, not stock portfolios, and that needs to change. Here in Washington.
The Kremlin admits it is suffering significant losses of troops since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. Russian forces are expected to withdraw from Kyiv and shift their attacks to the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his NATO counterparts in Brussels, Belgium, to discuss the U.S. response.
We're constantly going over what it is Ukraine needs, what it is we're providing, what it is we're helping other allies and partners provide.
Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council over reports of what it called gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights. Sharp declines in enrollment are forcing many community colleges to make drastic decisions. Executive Vice Chancellor for Policy and Strategy at the Tennessee Board of Regents, Russ Deaton, said schools in his state are experiencing enrollment drops not seen in two decades.
We're doing everything we can to turn that around. You're seeing our colleges be much more intentional about recruitment, both at the high school level, out of the community with adults, thinking much more deeply about how they better serve students.
This year, a record number of books have been banned or challenged in school districts across the nation. Advocates testified yesterday before the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Pennsylvania librarian Samantha Hall.
When books are removed, communities lose the voice that that book represents. Measuring the damage of lost voices is daunting and longitudinal.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An outbreak of bird flu has been found in at least 24 states, and Iowa is among the hardest hit. Outreach and advocacy groups are calling attention to factory farms and raising questions about whether they make the spread worse, especially for family farms. Mike Moen has more.
At least 24 states are seeing the bird flu virus quickly spread through their commercial flocks on poultry-producing farms. Iowa is at the center of it all, with renewed focus on potential stress for smaller producers and the role of factory farms. State and federal officials say nearly a dozen Iowa counties have seen outbreaks on farms. Celise Christie is with the group Practical Farmers of Iowa, which educates producers on making their land more resilient. She says while an outbreak within a smaller flock might not have the same ripple effect as a larger farm, it still poses challenges.
They have a bird that tests positive, and then they have to cull all of their flock. That turnaround is just much more of a detriment because they're starting all over again, as opposed to having, you know, maybe I'm a larger producer and I have 4 or 5 barns.
Ag experts say the virus has led to higher prices for products such as eggs. Christie notes that for smaller producers, there's potential impact on what they sell at places such as farmers markets. Nationally, other groups cite the impact of corporate farms and the need to limit concentrated animal feeding operations. But industry leaders insist those large facilities are well shielded from wild birds carrying the virus. DNR officials in affected states say the spread is linked to wild birds, such as ducks and geese. But Patty Lavero with the Campaign for Family Farms and the Environment says the nation has become too reliant on factory farms and that all it takes is for a virus to slip through and wreak havoc.
We are putting so many animals, often that are genetically identical, together in one place. The disease just runs through very quickly and does a tremendous amount of damage.
In Iowa, Christie says while producers with smaller flocks might be more susceptible to an outbreak, they are taking the threat seriously.
Our farmers are just as vigilant as a lot of the large producers, and even more so because many of our farmers have their animals either, you know, out on pasture or grazing. But that's not to say that our farmers aren't taking their own precautions.
Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, expect to see some scattered showers and a high of 50. Today in history, in 1975, baseball player Frank Robinson becomes the manager of the Cleveland Major League Baseball team, becoming the first African-American manager in the league. The quote of the day is from Robinson, who said, quote, "Pitchers did me a favor when they knocked me down. It made me more determined. They say you can't hit on your back, but I didn't hit on my back. I got up." The chairman of the Blackfeet Tribal Nation was removed from office yesterday after a vote from fellow tribal council members, and the Navajo Nation loosens its COVID restrictions. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Blackfeet Nation's Tribal Council voted Thursday to remove Chairman Timothy Davis from office. Blackfeet law enforcement recently arrested 9 people at his home, including members of his family, on drug-related charges. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council unanimously voted to unseat Davis. In a text message to MTPR, Davis said, quote, "It was unanimous, including my vote for relinquishment based on the arrests of my adult children, 4 who are still incarcerated," end quote. The FBI, along with tribal law enforcement last week, arrested 9 people at Davis's home on charges for the sale of fentanyl and methamphetamine. Drug possession and child endangerment charges were also filed. All who were arrested pleaded not guilty. Davis was not at home at the time and does not face any charges. The council voted to select Iliff Kipp Sr. to replace Davis as chairman. Kipp said in a statement, quote, "The Blackfeet Nation will continue to move forward in a positive way for all Blackfeet people." For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Navajo Nation health officials have further loosened COVID-19 restrictions as new infections continue to decline. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, more people will be allowed into businesses and to gather socially.
The Navajo Department of Health issued 3 emergency orders Tuesday that transitioned the tribe from orange status to the less restrictive yellow status. Under the relaxed rules, businesses like restaurants, hotels, and the tribe's 4 casinos can now operate at 75% capacity. In addition, up to 25 people are now allowed to gather for social functions, traditional ceremonies, and church services, and capacity limits for school sporting events have also been increased. The orders keep in place a reservation-wide mask mandate that applies to schools and all other public spaces for both tribal members and visitors. The Navajo Nation was hit particularly hard by the pandemic and at one point in 2020 had the highest per capita infection rate in the U.S. As a result, tribal officials have kept several mandates in place long after surrounding states like Arizona and Utah rescinded their own. The Navajo Nation experienced all-time high levels of COVID cases in mid-January, but in recent weeks, new infections have slowed to levels not seen since the summer. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Yurok tribe on Thursday celebrated the grand opening of the first tribally operated visitor center within California's state park system. The Chapek Akata Stone Lagoon Center is now operated by the tribe in a partnership with California State Parks. Recently renovated and renamed, it contains displays that reflect the tribe's long-standing cultural connection to the lagoon. Yurok interpreters will share the tribe's history from pre-contact to contemporary time with visitors. During a virtual celebration Thursday, manager Rosie Claiborne talked about how the public will be able to learn about tribal history, culture, and little-known facts about the park.
We have so many exhibits. We have so many stories to tell here. This place is so deep in history. Yurok people have always had a connection to this place, but it's never gone away. It's just a continuation through time.
The tribe also celebrated work to reintroduce the California condor. Later this month, the tribe and Redwood National Park plan to release 4 condors. They'll be the first to take flight in the region since the late 1800s. That effort has been underway by the tribe since 2008. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One online bank is making an effort to fund renewable energy, not fossil fuels. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Reducing climate change will require big investments. Banks can help accelerate the transition from fossil fuels by financing clean energy and efficiency solutions. Jason McDuff is president of GreenPenny, a virtual bank that was launched by Iowa-based Decora Bank. GreenPenny prides itself on being carbon neutral and only investing in climate solutions, ranging from home efficiency projects to large renewable energy installations.
We are all about financing a sustainable tomorrow. That's our mission. And so if that means solar, great. If it means geothermal, we will look at it. If it means wind, we will look at it.
For banking customers, GreenPenny offers checking and savings accounts. McDuff says consumers who are concerned about climate change can feel good about putting their money in these accounts.
So at GreenPenny, you can know that your deposits are only going to be used to finance sustainable practices like renewable energy systems or carbon reducing activities. And you can know they're not going to finance the fossil fuel industry or other carbon emitting things that might not be aligned with who you are.
So the approach allows GreenPenny to attract eco-conscious customers and make money while playing a critical role in reducing climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new federal report details the urgency of removing the four lower Klamath River dams. The removal process is now in the home stretch, with the demolition scheduled to begin in 2023. KBOO's Bronwyn Clark spoke with Brian Graber, a senior director for River Restoration for America Rivers, a conservation organization.
Few things have such a fundamental impact on a river as a dam. What harm have these four had on the Klamath River, its salmon, and the people who rely on it?
Number one, for more than a decade, it's the Native American tribes along the river who have been leading the effort to remove these four dams. And it's because the dams cause a terrible water quality problem. As they warm up, especially in the summer, that warm water causes the oxygen levels within the water to decrease. But then also, these stagnant pools that they create are a breeding ground for a cyanobacteria. It kind of looks like a fluorescent blue-green algae. And it is extremely toxic. It's so toxic that it can kill a dog and other small animals. And it has destroyed the salmon runs, along with just the barriers created by the dams.
Removing the dams will restore movement to the river. So what are some of the results we can expect to see?
Well, there's really no better way to bring a river back to life than removing a dam. And so along with the salmon runs, you know, we're expecting the full suite of everything from fish to small mammals, amphibians, reptiles to be restored on, you know, along the river length. But really, this is a food security and justice issue for the tribes that live along the river. And I think that far eclipses any other benefit of these projects is just bringing back salmon and steelhead, which were a primary food source for them for thousands of years.
What does the actual process of removing a dam look like?
Yeah, I think the anticipation is that there's a big explosion and then a sudden rush of water, and usually that's not the case at all. These projects are done in a very controlled manner, with the dam being, you know, notched progressively, such that we're slowly drawing down the water behind the dams. There's no rush of water, and everything happens pretty slowly, and I think it's disappointing if you were to stand there and watch the whole process. So the first thing that we do is bring down the water level by opening up gates or notching the dam. So the river is going to look like a river before the dams are even removed. And then slowly the structure itself will be dismantled.
These four dams have a combined height of 411 feet. How long will simultaneous removal take?
Yeah, once it starts, it's probably about a two-year construction. It's unusual for us to remove four dams all at once like this. So it's going to be a little bit more compressed than we might normally see, you know, because usually we would spread out these projects quite a bit. So with that compressed schedule, we expect the construction will be a couple of years.
Did you face any challenges in winning over the community support for this project?
Every dam removal project that we work on around the country has some opposition. And the concerns are usually that there's nobody left alive who remembers what the river was like before there was a dam there. And these dams have, on the Klamath, have been there for decades to a century. The first one was built in 1908. So they've been there for a long time. So that change is, it's difficult to manage, and it's understandable. People don't remember there being anything else there. And there are concerns about things like property values and things like that. This is a beautiful river. And if you go elsewhere along the river where there are not dams, you can see what it might look like when the projects are done. It's just an absolutely beautiful place.
The Klamath is known to be the world's biggest dam removal project, and I'm imagining that it's not going to be cheap. What kind of price tag will the demolition and habitat restoration plan have, and who's funding it?
The construction project is about a $450 million project. It's primarily funded by a combination of the owner of the dams, Pacific Corp, and their ratepayers. They've recognized that removing these dams is actually more economical than maintaining them and the continued operations, maintenance, dealing with the water quality issue, dealing with fish passage. And then the state of California is providing a large chunk of the money needed to remove these dams. Recently, in the infrastructure package that Congress passed back in the fall, they recognized the need to complete projects like this and included $800 million for dam removals in that infrastructure bill. So recognizing that, along with this being ecological restoration and, you know, a really great project for the tribes along the river, it's also an infrastructure project.
Are there any remaining hurdles your team has still to face before you can break ground, so to speak?
We do. We're still trying to work through the regulatory process. There are a lot of permits that are needed to do a project of this scale. We had a major milestone just a few weeks ago where one of the federal regulators, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they issued a statement that recommending that the dams were removed because of their economic and environmental impacts and their impacts on the tribes. So that was a major hurdle, but we still have to work through some additional federal permits and local permits as well.
Why is it so important that the dam removal remains on track to begin in 2023 and not get delayed any longer?
It's important, I mean, number one, to just get this project done. The tribes have been fighting for the removal of these dams for so long. Just keeping it on track to getting it done is important to them. It's important to us. But also, you know, we have construction firms and engineering design firms that are under contract that are working on the project, and the delays with their ability to bring construction equipment to the site and such, you know, costs a lot of dollars. So the longer it stretches out, the more we need to maintain their contract and adjust for inflation and so on.
Is there anything that we could do to help?
I think just check out our website. So this project is being managed by the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, and there still is a need for funding for, you know, some smaller pieces of the work, things like planning for recreation and things like that. So check out the KRRC website and consider donating to them.
American River's National Director of River Restoration, Brian Graber. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For KBOO News, I'm Bronwyn Clark.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 8th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Bronwyn Clark. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Nadia Ramlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, he wanted to go to the Capitol on January 6th, Donald Trump tells the Washington Post, but Secret Service wouldn't let him. He hated the violence and was furious Nancy Pelosi wasn't putting a stop to it. He doesn't remember getting many phone calls, and he didn't destroy any call logs. Trump would lie on credit when he could tell the truth for cash. So why are so many pundits invested in suggesting that he can never be legally brought to account? We'll hear from Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, about the stunning new ruling that shows a way to do just that. Also on the show, polls show 68% of people in the country think marijuana should be legal, the highest number since polling started in 1969. The tide is turning. It's just a matter of who we let be lifted by it and who we allow to drown. Should some people get rich selling weed while others rot in jail for it? That's what the MORE Act that just passed the House tries to address. We'll catch up with an expert on marijuana legislation, Mike Lazuski from the Enact Group. That's coming up, but first, a look back at some recent press. The confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court occasions a look back at some of the media coverage of her hearings. While media reported GOP senators' grandstanding harassment and aggressive repetition of baseless accusations, their need to always be signaling balance led to some mealy-mouthed avoidance tactics, like C-SPAN's tweet describing, quote, heated exchange between Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and Senator Lindsey Graham on child pornography sentencing, close quote, when anybody watching would tell you that only one side was heated. Or this piece from the Washington Post in late March that begins, quote, as Ketanji Brown Jackson this week sat through several days of hearings in her bid to join the Supreme Court, Democrats